You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 4th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
China decides that an annual press conference might be overdoing it. Kenya accepts the considerable challenge of imposing order on Haiti. And Miami appears to have had enough of stereotypically Florida behaviour. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Rebecca Tinsley and Ali Bohani will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll hear from Brian Klass about his new book, Fluke, which considers the colossal unlikelihood of pretty much everything. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Rebecca Tinsley, journalist and human rights campaigner, founder of Network for Africa, and by Ali Bohani, a strategy expert formerly based in Dubai and managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Ali is also co-host of BRI Dialogues. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello, Andrew.
And Ali, we will start with you because though listeners to The Globalist, those early rising weirdos, may have heard you on Monocle Radio once or twice. This is your first appearance on The Daily, so if you could please introduce yourself to our vast and curious global audience. How did you get here?
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you and Rebecca. I have had various roles in multiple corporations, from Bosch and Siemens as a head of corporate strategy and business development for Middle East and Africa, head of sales and business excellence for Philips. And most of my life has been in being a trusted advisor to the CEOs. And since I've left corporate world and being in charge of what I say, a contrarian advisory firm, helping senior decision makers, ultra high net worth individuals and family offices to make sense of the geopolitical changes and geostrategic changes to help them grow their businesses. In a nutshell, I'm three chiefs: a chief contrarian officer, because I always challenge the thinking. I am a chief welding officer for bringing people and ideas together, and chief storytelling officer. No, nothing more and nothing less.
Well, those three occupations will doubtless come in handy in the next half hour or so. Rebecca, you are by now fairly familiar, I think, to listeners of The Daily. We know who you are, but what have you been up to lately?
Well, I've had a little triumph recently, Andrew. About 5 years ago, in a very unpleasant Central African country, a young man that we will call William was walking past the opposition party headquarters when a raid happened, and he was picked up by the security services and taken to a military base. And for 2 days, he was tortured with hot irons all over his body. And I know this because I've got the photographs, and thrown into jail. And a couple of years ago, I sort of made friends with this chap over WhatsApp. And we tried all the sort of obvious ways to get him out of prison by hiring lawyers. And the trouble was that the regime kept changing its mind about what it is he'd done wrong. Was he a terrorist or was he in jail because he'd lost his ID card? And so finally, I said to him, well,
5 years seems like a bit of a stretch for losing an ID card.
Oh, yeah, but he was, they said they'd locked him up for 20 years. I mean, the real thing was that he was near the opposition headquarters. That's the real reason they arrested this poor young man. Anyway, I eventually said to William, what about bribery? And so he had a word with the clerk of the court, and she said, pay me about £2,000. And I went back and said, how about £1,000? And she said, done. And so at Christmas, my husband and I decided, you know, instead of spending that £1,000 on too much food and presents for people who are already rather privileged, why don't we do this? Anyway, he's now got the documents and he's going to be out of prison.
Well, hello to him if and when he gets around to listening to this podcast. But we will start today's show proper in China, not usually noted as a model of transparent relationships between government and press, but which had at least indulged a tradition these last few years under which the premier, currently Li Qiang, would pretend to answer a few questions from foreign reporters following the annual two sessions conclave of China's parliament, which is presently underway in Beijing. This year, however, Li will not be fielding inquiries from visiting hacks. Indeed, there will be no such interactions for the rest of this congressional term, i.e. another 3 years. Explanations have been unforthcoming. In the absence of unforthcoming explanations, that is a shocking double negative this early in the week. You know what I'm saying. Ali, first of all, would you like to speculate wildly as to what is going on here?
I imagine that China is shifting gears. China is preparing at home and abroad for some major changes. This idea that, you know, China's economic development is stuttering and, you know, the real estate is going to bring it all down is a bit overrated. I think it's too early to sing a eulogy for, China's economic trajectory. And I think at the moment they are focusing on giving more power to the ministries. Mm-hmm. So I think Xi Jinping is putting them on the spot. And in the background, of course, they're focused on a 5% growth rate, which we say, puh, China, 5%. What is 5%?
There's a lot of countries that would be real happy with
5%. Absolutely. And if this is the type of challenge we're receiving on electronic, you know, electric mobility and EV cars only with 5%, we can only imagine what would we be dealing with at 8 or 9%. So I think the focus moving forward is on advanced manufacturing. And that is why you will see three particular, ministries will be put forward. Ministry of, Information Technology and Ministry of Science and Technology. Both of them have technology in it to emphasize housing and urban and rural development. So the focus is inwards. I think at the moment they're as well in a Tai Chi mode, not in a karate or judo mode, and looking as to what November will bring. And with clearance of Donald Trump today from the Supreme Court that he can run, I think we will see more of a listening mode from Beijing in the next 10 months.
Rebecca, is there also, this does seem like a weird thing to find yourself saying about a political culture which was already fairly cloistered and secretive, China growing even more cloistered and secretive, because, of course, recent events within the CCP include things like the vanishings, as far as anyone can tell, of one former foreign minister and one former defence minister. Do we really have, it seems really strange that inside the country which may already be the world's primary economic power, we have so little idea of what is actually occurring at the top of its government.
Well, we're very lucky to have Ali here. And I wonder, when I read this news about this press conference being cancelled, I wondered if this was part of a trend with President Xi centralizing more and more and the primacy of the Communist Party as opposed to the bureaucrats in China.
And because it's not hard, it strikes me, to just stand up through one press conference, you know, every year or so. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. I'll take a few questions. You're out of there in less than an hour.
Indeed. And we all know it's ceremonial anyway. But it isn't just the disappearance of politicians. It's also any businessman, any entrepreneur who gets too big for his boots as well.
But that does prompt the question, Ali, or at least it did to me. Does this sort of behaviour by China, and there is now a pattern of it going back, well, you could argue that it goes back centuries, but certainly back to the beginnings of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, that China has become more cloistered, more secretive, you could even say more paranoid. This is not encouraging foreign investment. I mean, surely foreign companies, the corporations that China needs to invest in China, are just going to look at this and think it's a big world. We can go somewhere else.
I would have agreed with you if the numbers on the ground would have supported that. BASF, which is the largest chemical company in the world, unpacked, mothballed its plant after the cut of Nord Stream and is investing 10 billion euros in China. in Ludwigshafen, so they're replicating that. You look at Diageo and Pernod Ricard setting up distilleries for, you know, the consumer markets. The highest returns for LVMH anywhere in the world in the luxury sector are in China. And the fact of the matter is China is perhaps the way to read it as well from an outsider's perspective, is focusing on the global south. China's trade with emerging markets has increased. China's lending in renminbi has increased from 20% in 2002 to 52% in 2022. So they are very much focused on attracting investment from sovereign wealth funds in the GCC. So their optics are changing. They're saying, we need their oil. They need our investment. They don't want to recycle their dollars in U.S. after the freezing of assets of Russia. So there is a restructuring in the global order, Andrew. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that China is very much concerned about that, because in many ways they are looking as well at this dual circulation, which has been the agenda of Xi Jinping. How successful he will be is subject to, you know, time. And but they're very much looking into sourcing foreign direct investment from different players. But you will be seeing charm offensives from Beijing in opening up the fiscal landscape and investments and luring the bankers and investment firms from, I would say, mostly the GCC and the global south.
Well, sticking with the theme of a restructuring world, let's move along and look at Haiti. The perennially luckless and lawless Caribbean state has long since landed in that unhappy file of things everybody agrees something should be done about, while nobody wants to be the one to do it. Help may shortly be arriving, however, in the form of a force led by 1,000 police officers from Kenya. Kenya's president, William Ruto, put his hand up for the task last year, only to have it slapped back down by Kenya's High Court, who ruled that a formal agreement with Haiti would be necessary. Haiti's Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, has now visited Kenya to dot the necessary I's and cross the pertinent T's. Rebecca, this is no small ask. Most of Port-au-Prince, Haiti's capital, is now believed to be run by gangs. Another 3,700 inmates escaped from a prison over the weekend, which probably is not going to help matters. Somebody, I think it has to be, it should be said, has to take on Haiti's gangs. Is Kenya the country to do it?
Well, first of all, it isn't just the 300 gangs who behave with utter impunity. Sadly, it is actually the ruling class of Haiti who are complicit, the cops, the politicians. And this has been going on for a very, very long time. The rot is at the top and with the elite. And I really don't think that with the best will in the world, sending 1,000 Kenyan police is going to solve it. And I was alarmed to read that a former cop called Guy Philippe, who's been in jail for the last 6 years in the States because he's actually a crook, he came back to Haiti in November and he delivered a really not very thinly veiled threat to the Kenyan mission. So I really do. I wish them the best. But my other concern about the Kenyans arriving is that 10 years ago, when there was a terrorist attack at a shopping mall in Nairobi at Westgate, unfortunately, the cops seemed to make it their priority to loot the place. They did the same when Nairobi Airport burned down a few years ago. They looted the place. And I'm not totally convinced that they will improve things in Haiti, especially when you look at the record of the previous peacekeepers to Haiti who brought cholera with them. And that was the Nepalese. And the Sri Lankan peacekeepers set up sex trafficking networks.
I mean, it is far from a risk-free undertaking. The likelihood is that this will cost Kenya, certainly in terms of money and very probably in terms of casualties. That being the case, Ali, are there selfish reasons for Kenya wanting to do this? Kenya's Foreign Minister Alfred Mutua has said that it would raise Kenya's global profile, also said that Kenya would be doing God's will.
Well, I think these are nice for the headlines, but a deal financed by U.S. backed by UN, as Rebecca highlighted the shortcomings and failures of, cholera and the issues there, and manned by Kenya, delivered in Haiti, is a far-fetched in terms of success. But one would think that if you wanted to bring forces in order to suppress and you wanted a grip like that, you wouldn't go 13,956 kilometers to Nairobi. You would go 1,890 kilometers to El Salvador and would ask, Nayib Bukele, who is now very hard-handed with that. But that's not the answer. Rebecca would first be to tell you that this is an issue of mental health, a country that has been ravaged by earthquakes, the country that has been left for far too long by, not supported of the international community to rebuild. So sending 1,000 people to fix, Haiti, good luck with that. I don't think that's...
I mean, Rebecca, it may not just be 1,000 people. Benin has also volunteered for this and said it would send 2,000 troops. There may be more where this is coming, but isn't the difficulty with addressing all the things about Haiti that Ali highlighted, and if we highlighted all the things there are with Haiti, we could be here all night. But the first thing that has to happen is the gangs have to be disarmed and order has to be imposed, because if you don't do that, you can't do anything else.
Absolutely. But first of all, you said that it would cost Kenya. It won't. It will be a profit center. All countries sending troops to peacekeeping missions make a profit on it. They're also going is Burundi, Chad, Senegal.
This being because the UN pays their wages
exactly
while they're in country.
Yep. And believe me, the peacekeepers don't see that. Whether this is a success or not comes back to New York, and whether the United Nations has the political will to make this a success, to stop the weapons going in there, to make sure that the Prime Minister actually enforces all the agreements he has already signed. And if I might, I remember a conversation I had 20 years ago in Darfur when I was there at the height of the killing, and I asked the local people, the survivors in the IDP camp in Sudan, I said to them, do you want peacekeepers to come here? And they said to me, yes, we want white ones. And I asked the translator, are you sure? They said white ones. And the local ladies I was speaking to said, oh, yes, for two reasons. The first is that the white ones will come from countries that are wealthy enough that they won't steal everything from us. And the second reason that we want white boys, as they called them, to come here, is that they'll find it so unpleasant that they'll so unpleasant here that they will want to get the job done efficiently so they can go home quickly.
What they're kind of saying that they wanted there is professional militaries.
Precisely.
And is the problem, Ali, that I guess, and especially this, my potted theory on this is that this is a 21st century hangover from the misadventure in Iraq in particular, that Western nations now feel themselves out of the intervention business.
No, I think, listen, intervention business is a very profitable business for the ones who supply and do the catering. And, even in Iraq, it's not like it's everybody's been a loss. But you look at Haiti, you look at, it's a deep-rooted trauma. It's from the time of the post-French repatriation, So the country has been going from not healing from its old days, then natural disasters, then no work in terms of structural reforms to help and heal. There's one thing to give money and commit, and, Bill Clinton goes there and announces something. How much is deployed? How much is put to bringing first the alignment between health, sanitation, and housing? Then we can talk. I mean, there are neighborhoods like Canaan, Jerusalem, slums in Haiti that, they're... They, by any standards, they are threatening for anybody, even the Haitian. It's not, I think, till we don't address the fundamental issues, it doesn't work. You can deploy the, Rebecca was in a, very wise way addressing the comments she heard, but there's no shortage of footprints of the Dutch UN peacekeepers who were messing up as well.
I think
we have to be a little bit mindful about where we're coming from to know where we're going. And I think that is, Haiti needs a compass on that front more than troops.
Well, let's move along. And one might have hoped by now everybody would understand that the security of our personal communications cannot be taken for granted. One might certainly have assumed that this fact of life would be apprehended by senior military staff. Apparently not. Germany has conceded that audio of a conversation among Luftwaffe brass gleefully released by Russia is genuine. In the conversation, four German officers, including Air Force Chief Lieutenant General Ingo Gerhardt, are heard discussing the dispatch of the German-Swedish Taurus cruise missile to Ukraine and referring to British personnel in Ukraine assisting with the operation of the Storm Shadow cruise missile already there. Rebecca, first of all, every time there's a leak of any sort, people get terribly excited by the fact of the leak. This is all tremendously good fun for everybody. It always is, hearing a conversation you weren't supposed to hear. But in terms of the actual content, is there anything here that tells us anything we didn't already know or couldn't have guessed?
No, but I'm sure that on two levels, it will have made Putin's day, week, month or year. And that is, first of all the detail that was revealed about how the UK and the French are going to deliver their respective missile systems. That cannot be helpful. But also just the sheer propaganda victory for the Kremlin, because now they can say to their own people, we told you so, They're planning on invading, you know.
Well, yes, Dmitry Medvedev, the former president, who may have started early, it's always a consideration, I think, with Medvedev, has said that the call of the great patriotic war has become relevant again, death to the German Nazi occupiers, which is not helpful. But this intercept has given Russia a cue for this sort of stuff. But again, Ali, there's a similar question with that. So Russia makes hay with this, fine, but that's not going to change anybody's mind, is it?
I think there are other vectors here to look at as well, Andrew. One is that this is happening a few days after Emmanuel Macron said, you know, we have to put boots on the ground. So that is a bit, you know, and at the same time, a few days after Olaf Scholz denying that, no, we don't want to have any boots on the ground. So that shows a little bit of a, I would say, disconnection between what has happened. Rebecca touched on it. It's 19th of February. They spoke for 38 minutes. So, you know, it wasn't like a small conversation. 38 minutes on a WebEx Cisco unencrypted system. I don't know how will that go down. But the impact on Europe with a Trump coming to the office. So how will Europe react to this in 6 months' time, in 9 months' time, if Trump is in the office and Kremlin says, no, we're going to double down. There are other elements as well, you know. So if you're investing as Germany behind the doors on these missiles, and then Rheinmetall, which is the largest producer of military equipment, going to invest, will that as well be in the eyes of Moscow a fair target, a bullseye? So I think it's much more complex than just the gossiping thing. And we don't have to forget that US, you know, NSA and Danish information cables in 2021 were listening to Angela Merkel. And so this business of listening to one another is not something that is privy of just Russia or, you know, United States. The key question is if this is perhaps, in my opinion, a conversation leak that has led to damage of not just the bridge that they wanted to blow up, the Kerch bridge
they talk about, yeah.
But it has blown up the bridge of trust between Germany and, you know, UK and, you know, others. So how we're going to fix that bridge first before blowing anything else up?
Well, that does prompt the question, Rebecca, of whether this will certainly occasion an amount of exasperation among Germany's partners. But that exasperation is... Well, there's a background to that. The Germans, I think, are still regarded for all that they have increased their defense spending, for that Olaf Scholz did talk about this change in mindset a couple of years ago. There is still a sense that Germany is perhaps arguably even self-indulgently hamstrung by its own history on matters of defense.
Operation Barbarossa. Yeah. But Scholz is very much of that generation who were so keen to embrace Russia at the end of the Cold War. And, to, you know, he is very heavily invested, you know, like so many of his countrymen in commercial opportunities, cheap gas, but also an aversion to dealing with unpleasantness. And one has to say about Scholz, it's like he doesn't know how to deal with bullies. You know, I mean, and this is really important because he keeps signaling to the Russians exactly what Germany's afraid of, rather than, you know, and you don't get anywhere by signaling your weakness to your enemy.
But is this something, just finally on this one, Ali, something that the rest of Europe doesn't fully understand or won't fully understand about Germany, how deep this stuff still cuts? And I have had conversations with current and former senior German politicians and diplomats in the last couple of years who have said, yeah, it is exactly what you think it is. As one put it to me, it is the spectacle of German tanks being loaded onto trains and sent east to fight the Russians. It makes a lot of Germans incredibly unhappy.
I think you and Rebecca are right in saying that there is this, you know, shadow from the Second World War still there. But the key question as well is the German street. You know, this year or last year, $135 billion of FDI left Germany, including some of the examples. Only $10.5 billion went in. So Christian Lindner, who is the finance minister at World Economic Forum, recently said Germany is the tired man of Europe. And if that is the strongest member of Europe, what that tells about EU and the sentiments on the street and the average German guy, what would they think if there's a body bag coming from Kiev? So they cannot be, there's an expression in Middle East, they say you cannot be on the back of a camel and bend and expect nobody sees you if you're riding it. Yeah, so if you're out there, as Rebecca says, you have to be out there. But I don't think neither there is the, you know, coherence within EU nor economic, I would say, you know, wars are expensive.
But while we're slagging off the poor old Germans, let's not forget that eventually they, you know, they have been very reluctant about sending material. But they have eventually, at the end, done that. And let's not forget that the French, for all their talk, are still really dragging their feet on sending weapons and money.
Let's pivot to something entirely more trivial. With an audible grinding of gears, we move on to tourism advertising, which has generally and understandably been focused on encouraging people to visit a given place. In recent times, however, a new genre has emerged of anti-tourist advertising from beleaguered destinations seeking to deter a particular demographic. The latest is Miami, which appears to have wearied of the kind of people for whom the word party is a verb.
And just so you know, we're serious.
This March, you can expect things like curfews, bag checks, and restricted beach access.
DUI checkpoints, $100 parking, and strong police enforcement for drug possession and violence.
Rebecca, are you now less likely to spend spring break in Miami?
Yeah, I am. But I really don't want to be the British person who crows about this, because lest we forget that the British have been disinvited, uninvited from Mallorca, from other parts of Spain and from Amsterdam, where they are fed up of seeing us. And incidentally, a lot of those folk, I guess, who would have gone to Amsterdam and their brothers and cousins, you know, are heading for Miami, they go to Blackpool, where I have to tell you, I don't know whether how recently you spent a night in Blackpool.
It's been a while. I have, however, been there.
Well, I've had too many nights in Blackpool at stupid political events. And this is a place where the hotels, as routinely put incontinence pads on every bed.
See, I don't know if Blackpool put that in their advertising, whether that would attract or deter people. I guess it depends, as it does with this ad, who you are after. Ali, is this going to work? Is this going to deter spring breakers from descending upon Miami?
Well, listen, I think these days everything is dependent on how many times you post it on TikTok, how many followers it catches, and what sort of digital media.
Well, we're talking about it.
No, I know. I'm just saying that, you know, the fact of the matter is it would make a good campaign that, you know, if Havana would say, come here and what you cannot do in Miami, do in Havana. You know, that would be a contrarian campaign. But I was reading over the weekend about Madrid real estate market, and a lot of people from Miami are moving to raise families in Madrid because of being a Spanish-speaking city and the cost of living and the rest of it. One line really caught my attention in that ad that was, we just want different things. And when you're a destination, you know, on attitudes, I agree with Rebecca. But the fact of the matter is, again, police and, you know, I think you develop by leading by example. You know, I think you cannot portray your city as the destination of being the wildest party city in the world and then tell people this is the way we party, you know? I think it's one of those, you know, Biscayne Bay and under deck project. Maybe they should allocate 33 acres on the landscape for some, you know, naughtiness under the highway rather than on the beach.
See, Rebecca, this is what I end up wondering, whether they have thought this all the way through, because so you deter the spring breakers, and they have, in fairness to them, reasonable grounds to want to do that. Last year's spring break in Miami, 488 arrests, quite a lot of them serious felonies, 100 firearms seized. I can kind of see that the local police and local authorities are thinking, I don't really want to spend spring doing all of that again. But if Miami does scare off the tequila-swilling yahoos in floral shirts, who else is coming?
Well, indeed, or is it the usual snowbirds from New Jersey?
Or Toronto.
And how much disposable income do they have? But if you don't mind, I want to bring the shame back home again by reminding you of, you know, all those videos you see on YouTube of British people on Ryanair and EasyJet sort of fighting each other and slugging it out in the aisles on their way to bring mayhem to some unsuspecting poor little corner of Spain. But they are, of course, the inheritors of the Bollinger Club tradition, aren't they? I mean, we do, you know,
I wouldn't know, Rebecca. I'm Australian, and obviously everybody is always delighted to see us.
But I think there's another point there as well, that I think the fact of the gun violence makes a big difference. Mm. I mean, the figure you just shared with us would send shiver on the back of any visitor, you know. 400, you know, gun violence cases, spoken, as you said.
Spoken as a Canadian.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's just...
Well, spring break in Calgary for everybody then. Rebecca Tinsley and Ali Bahani, thank you both for joining us. And finally on today's show, if you will embrace a fleeting moment of existential panic, consider the astonishing odds against you even listening to this. And this is no reflection on Monocle Radio's impressively immense global audience, merely a reminder that your very existence is a freakishly infinitesimal statistical outlier. Once you start thinking like that, pretty much everything seems a marvel, but what do we do with this knowledge? Brian Klass, political scientist and contributor to The Atlantic, has been giving the matter some thought. His conclusions take the form of a new book, Fluke: Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. I spoke to Brian at Midori House earlier and began by asking if this had been some COVID-related insight. Some adventurous gourmand in China decides to try the bat bourguignon and puts the whole world under house arrest.
I think it certainly affected how I wrote the book, but it's not where the idea came from. So I've been thinking about this for about 12 years, and I describe myself as a disillusioned social scientist in the book. And it's because every time I was trying to cram the world into neat and tidy models in which, you know, six variables explain everything, I just thought I was being dishonest. And that was because I was doing field work at the same time that I was doing quantitative analysis. And so I've long had this view. And the origin story also, which I mentioned in the opening chapter, is a story from 1905 in a little farmhouse in Wisconsin where a woman named Clara Maudlin Jansen had a mental breakdown. And she killed her four young children and then took her own life. And her husband came home and found the family dead. And it's in my book because it's my great-grandfather's first wife. And the origin story of my existence, which I only found out in my mid-20s, is that I'm the byproduct of a mass murder because my great-grandfather remarries to my great-grandmother and that becomes the lineage that produces me. So I've long felt like a fluke, and I think a lot of the stuff I've been thinking about professionally has given me that appreciation for the noise, which we are so often told by the smart thinkers of the world to ignore. Mm. I think it's where a lot of the most interesting and consequential things happen.
I mean, the fluke you refer to, the fluke of your existence, is of course reflected in all our lives. Most of us don't have something as tragic and gruesome and dramatic as that. But as your book makes clear, we are all only sitting here because there is this unbroken chain stretching back immemorial millennia of the right people turning up at the right time, and here we still are. But once you start thinking about the world like that, it does seem actually fairly self-evident that we are all here because of extraordinary strokes of luck. We bumble through this existence, bouncing off 7.5 billion other beneficiaries of the same fluke, to borrow your title. Why do we as a species have a hard time internalizing that? Why do we keep searching for order? Why do we keep insisting that something must be making sense?
Yeah, so you've hit on something that I found really remarkable. Since I've started talking about the book, I haven't actually had that much pushback on the argument. I think like a lot of people accept that this is how the world is, and we've just been deluded into thinking otherwise in two ways. One is our brains are designed to make pattern detection. That's basically what we do. So the way that humans have survived is they get really good at detecting patterns that help us survive long enough to reproduce, and that's the engine of evolution. So when things are random or arbitrary or accidental, we stitch them into a neat and tidy story. There's this phrase by Jonathan Gottschall. He calls us the storytelling animal. And I think there's a lot of evidence, which I go through in Fluke, that explains why we have to process reality in these neat and tidy ways. But I also think it's gotten on sort of overdrive in the modern world, because so much of our world runs on models. Economics runs on models. Like, we encounter Google Maps to navigate the world, all this stuff. And what I think has started to leach into our thinking is that the model is the world, and it's not. And it's really dangerous to think that way. When economists think the model is the world, they have hubris to believe they can control what I think is basically an uncontrollable level of complexity. And so they start to intervene and manipulate things in ways that are highly dangerous at times and lead to black swan events or catastrophes and cascades and so on. So I think, you know, we live in this world where we have the illusion of control. And I think we live in the most regularized environment that's ever existed. I mean, Starbucks in London is all the same, but so is Starbucks if you go to a different country. And so you have this sort of weird dynamic where we have the most predictable, stable daily lives that have ever existed for humans in the history of our species. But the superstructure of our world is changing faster than ever before, and it's also becoming more prone to calamity than ever before, because the 21st century is just a series of large catastrophic shocks that upend everything. And I think that's the sort of dynamic where we delude ourselves into believing that everything fits these patterns, and then we continually get walloped by pandemics, financial collapses, the Arab Spring, etc., and then we don't learn the lesson.
The kind of upbeat refrain of your book is that once you take on board that anything can cause anything, the idea then becomes that everything we do can actually matter, that nothing we do is meaningless. But how do you mitigate against the terror that goes along with that? Because however good our intentions may be, we can't always govern the consequences. My own workaday journey coming here today might have strewn unimaginable chaos in its wake for reasons I cannot begin to comprehend.
Yeah, well, I've thought about this because everything that's good in my life is result in part of 4 children being killed, right? So I'm completely aware of the morally neutral aspects of these things, in the sense where some terrible action can yield a life that I find valuable and meaningful and so on. I think the way that you navigate the world is you accept the uncertainty. I can never know how this conversation is going to affect the world. So it might send somebody into intense existential despair, and I'm sorry if that happens.
We do our best.
But the thing is, what you do is you make judgments based on probabilistic reasoning of what you think on balance is going to produce good outcomes. And usually that's a pretty good way of living life. It's, you think about like what's going to help other people, what's going to make the world a slightly better place. And every so often you do something, you plant a tree to sort of help the next generation, and some kid falls out of it and dies. I mean, it's not like you shouldn't plant trees. It's that you have a sort of idea that there's a simultaneous appreciation that nothing is meaningless, which I think actually feels very uplifting and empowering to me, but also that there's a certain level of lack of control. So the words that I come back to again and again in Fluke, I say, we control nothing, but we influence everything. Mm. And it's not just a mantra. It's also something that when you accept that you control nothing, it liberates you a little bit, because we're all control freaks in the modern world. But it also makes you have less hubris in social change that is dangerous. And this is the thing that I really do worry about, is that because of this illusion of control, we have more and more attempts to sort of cram the complexity of the world into this neat and tidy, you know, something we can manipulate basically at our whims, and it usually backfires. And then we think, oh, there's an external shock. It's like, no, it wasn't external. It was the system operating the way that we've designed it to, which is to say very, very prone to flukes.
That was Brian Klass, and his tremendous new book, Fluke, is available now, and you should read it. That is all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Rebecca Tinsley and Ali Bohani. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by Neoma Ekwe. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.